For the longest time, I thought Bitcoin was stupid and it has to go to zero because it will be hacked and it's just like World of Warcraft gold or something. In the beginning, I thought I understood it, but the more I studied it, the more I realized that I'm completely mistaken and I just had no idea about what money is and had no idea about game theoretic aspect of what makes the whole system work. Once I kind of understood more about it, I just had to write about it.
This is the Bitcoin Infinity Podcast,
a show where we take you through the Bitcoin rabbit hole and beyond.
Hope you enjoy the episode. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Bitcoin Infinity Podcast. My name is Ram.
And I'm Krishna.
And on this episode, we have a very special guest. We are sitting down with Gigi. Gigi is someone who needs no introduction in the Bitcoin space. But for those of our listeners who don't know who Gigi is a software engineer, a prolific writer, has written some of the most amazing articles in the Bitcoin space. Gigi is also an author of a book called 21 Lessons, which I highly recommend. And Gigi is also in the process of writing another book called 21 Ways, which I'm waiting for a long time. He has many projects that I admire, projects that help drive Bitcoin education, like bitcoinresources.com, 21.world, which I recently discovered, a German podcast that he started called Ein und Zwanzig. Hopefully I'm pronouncing it right.
Nice, very good.
And Bitcoin Codes, like the list goes on and on. Thanks for all your contribution and thanks for coming on the show.
Hey guys, thanks for having me. I'm, as you said, I'm involved in too many things. I think I couldn't even list it myself. So I'm in the process of trying to remove myself from some of the projects. So if someone wants to help out, reach out to me.
Definitely, like your kind of work is what I kind of admire, and I want to do it myself, but somehow I need to put my priorities back in order to make sure I focus more on Bitcoin soon. That's my focus.
Yeah, that's right. Only 144 blocks in a day, and you have to spend the time wisely.
Exactly.
And one more thing I wanted to add with this thing was the bitcoinresources.com. I think Gigi was the first person who reached out to us and said, hey, you guys are doing this podcast and I'm going to put it on bitcoinresources.com for beginners. And we thought, okay, someone's actually, noting our work. You know what? We should be more consistent with the podcast that we record and things like that. So that was actually very motivational. I don't know how much work it was for you to just put our website there, but it meant a lot more for us. And I'm sure, that's one of the main factors to, keep us recording, keep us moving forward. It's like a check on ourselves as well. So thanks for doing that, Gigi.
Yeah, you're very welcome. And thanks for doing what you guys are doing. I listened to a couple of episodes and that's also why I tweeted it out and put it on Bitcoin Resources, because I think it's so great that all over the world, people are motivated enough to, just do something for Bitcoin and educate others. And I know it's a lot of work, I didn't think at first that starting a podcast would be a lot of work, but I know it takes a lot of motivation and a lot of work to prepare and, not make a complete fool out of yourself every time you're recording. So yeah, thanks guys for doing that. And again, thanks for having me. I think it's really cool what you're doing.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you and really appreciate you listening more than one episode. not a lot of friends listen to all of them, so really appreciate on that. Yeah, let's kick things off with your background story. You were a software engineer. You were writing automated passport processing software. How did you end up in Bitcoin land?
Yeah, I kind of... It took me a very long time. So I think everyone kind of kicks himself a little bit after the fact that, you heard about Bitcoin the first time years ago and you dismissed it. I think that's the usual story. And that was definitely true for me too. And so I wish I kind of would have gotten into Bitcoin sooner for many reasons, not only stacking more sats when they were cheaper, but also just taking it more seriously early on, because I learned so much from Bitcoin. That's also why the subtitle of 21 Lessons is what I learned from falling down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. I think it's just insanely, endlessly stimulating on intellectually. Like every day I learn something new by just trying to wrap my head around Bitcoin. And so, yeah, I it took me a long time to not dismiss it anymore. And it was kind of a combination of not being happy with what I was doing. So as you mentioned, I mean, I worked on multiple projects back then, but one of the bigger ones was actually doing automated passport control systems. And not everyone who is working on this is an absolute terrible person, but it became clearer and clearer to me that even though a lot of people that are working on those things want to do the right thing, it's basically impossible to get it through. Like these systems are built, and some of the engineers, for example, they worked on very elaborate, very privacy preserving ways of doing this, you know, like implementing zero knowledge proofs. Is this person on a terrorist watch list or not? Or like, is this person of age or not? And so on. Like, so the zero knowledge proofs are now, you know, fancy and interesting again in the Bitcoin world for other things. And many years ago, people were already trying to implement those kind of systems so that not all the data is just stored in one silo and gets abused, and so that the possibility for abuse is minimized and so on. But it just never turns out this way. It's you know, like some political decision is made, and then the more sane way of doing things is just not implemented. And that's also, I think, why these systems always get abused. It's also, if you build it first the right time, it's very much like, I don't know, if you look at the current smartphones, you can unlock them with your face, for example, you know, and with your fingerprint and so on. And you, like, if Apple is to be trusted, and again, you can't really verify it because it's not open source, but the way they say they are doing is, it is no biometrics are ever stored. It's just, you know, like they extract the important data and they match it, but they don't really save your fingerprint and they don't save your face and so on. But it doesn't really matter, because now people are used to it and they're using it all the time. And so if in 10 years from now or in 5 years from now, some other company does the same thing and they store all the data, they store every single face and they store every single fingerprint that you enter into the system, then again, it's bad. So it's kind of, there is no right way of doing this if the approach is already wrong, kind of. And so I got increasingly frustrated with those kind of things. And I just knew that I had to work on something else. And I was always very interested in encryption and open source and also artificial intelligence and those kind of things. And so then Bitcoin came along. And I mean, I heard about Bitcoin multiple times over multiple years. And again, it took me a long time to not dismiss it anymore. And it was finally when the bull run in 17 started, where I was like, okay, there's something there that I'm kind of not understanding. So I kind of burnt down my old life, quit my job, and did nothing but study Bitcoin for, like, you know, 20 hours a day or something, like no more sleep. And I just wanted to kind of find out what I'm not understanding, because to me, I thought that for the longest time, I thought Bitcoin was stupid and it has to go to zero because it will be hacked and it's just like World of Warcraft gold or something. And in the beginning, I thought I understood it, but the more I studied it, the more I realized that I'm completely mistaken and I just had no idea about what money is and had no idea, like, about the kind of game theoretic aspect of what makes the whole system work. And so once I kind of understood more about it, I just had to write about it. And that's how 21 Lessons came to be. And ever since, yeah, I've been working full-time in Bitcoin. I was lucky enough to, I mean, with a software background, it's not that hard to find something in the Bitcoin space to do, so to speak. And yeah, ever since I'm full-time in Bitcoin. And the only regret that I have is I wish I would have made the jump sooner.
Yeah, that's always the case, right? Like, even back in like 2015, I gave like a presentation at work about Bitcoin, about double spending, never even bothered to even get my toes dipped into Bitcoin, not even by a couple of dollars. Yeah. And one thing that I wanted to ask you was, like, the problem with like approaching Bitcoin is from a technical perspective, like being a software engineer, it's so simple that it's so hard to believe. Like, I see a lot of software engineers not believing what Bitcoin is. Like, they're not believing that Bitcoin is money, and they start to stray towards other projects Did that ever happen to you?
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't Ethereum more attractive than Bitcoin in 2017?
I had a long shitcoin phase. And that was also when I was not full-time in the space yet. I was very interested in all those things. So I kind of have a background in distributed systems and graph theory and those kind of things. And I was always a big fan in kind of eliminating single points of failure. And so I also used BitTorrent a lot, for example. And I was a big fan of those ideas of just building things so they cannot be shut down. And that was also like, it took me a long time to actually realize that. Like, it's funny now looking back, but it took me a long time that Bitcoin is such a thing, to understand that Bitcoin is such a thing. And so when I began to look at, into it more closely, I was very interested in the first forks of Bitcoin, and Namecoin was the first one, you know, like where the idea was to decentralize DNS. And I, as an engineer, I knew that DNS is a centralized attack point of the internet. And so I was very interested in this, and hey, that this could actually work. I didn't know back then that you needed a shitcoin for it to work, and the shitcoin needed to be money for the whole system to work, and it kind of competes in the monetary space in Bitcoin, and it needs this utility token and so on and so forth. And so I was very bullish on those kind of ideas and those kind of things. And when Ethereum came around, I had a very prolonged shitcoin phase. So I was very bullish on unstoppable code. And that's what kind of what's so funny now is that most people that criticize me for my Bitcoin maximalism, they assume that I never looked into anything else, and I always was a maximalist, and they think I have no idea about Ethereum. I have a good idea about Ethereum. You know, I was an ETH head myself, kind of, you know, I mean, I never held large amounts or anything like that. So I was never in it to get rich or to speculate on it. But from the technical side of things, I understand Ethereum, I think, better than most people with .eth in their handles.
Yeah, if you don't have a shitcoining phase, then it's going to be hard to believe that you're a Bitcoin maximalist.
There are very few people. I think you need to understand what money is deeply, and you need to understand the monetary properties of money and of Bitcoin deeply to skip the shitcoin phase. So there are some people, there are some of the Austrians that never got into shitcoins, really, like Pierre Rochard and Bitstein and so on. Like they had they were kind of lucky that they already were Austrians before they discovered Bitcoin.
Yeah, if you're approaching it from Austrian economics perspective, yeah, totally agree. If you're approaching it from a technical standpoint, it's going to be really hard to avoid. That's why we are focusing very much on stressing. Like, we had an episode dedicated to like how to avoid shitcoins. Speaking of which, like, we spoke a lot about like proof of work versus proof of stake, and what do you have to say about proof of work and other consensus mechanism? And I know you have like an amazing piece called Bitcoin is Time. So do you want to talk about proof of work, how Bitcoin is Time eventually? I'll leave it to you.
Yeah, of course. So that's kind of, it kind of became my main my main topic for some reason. But I think it is because you have to understand proof of work to really understand Bitcoin. And you also have to understand the problems that proof of work solves to understand Bitcoin, and to understand its clones, and to understand shitcoins, and to also understand why shitcoins fail. And I mean, we saw so many failures of shitcoins just in the last couple of months alone. So many proof of stake shitcoins, they had, you know, like timing failures. And that's what Bitcoin is Time is about. That proof of work is a way of building up its own arrow of time in cyberspace. It's a way of decentralizing time itself, in the sense that you have to build up your own sequence of events that is trustless. There is no way to tell the time in a decentralized system. That just isn't, because of physics. You know, I mean, it's a very heady topic, so it's kind of hard to sum it up in like a minute or two. But there is a reason why some of the proof of stake shitcoins, you know, their internal clock was off by like 30 minutes, and the whole project failed basically and had to be restarted and so on. And this happens all the time, and this has to happen all the time. And this is also why proof of stake systems are susceptible to timing attacks. A lot of like many attacks, you can attack proof of stake systems in many different ways, but one of the easiest attacks is are always related to time. The other attack is related to the fact that proof of stake has no relationship to reality. So you can make up something you can make up two histories. Like you can have the quote unquote real history that most people agree upon, but you can at very little cost create an alternative history where you are rich and everyone else is poor, and you can just, you know, act as if this is what actually happened in the whole system. And there is no easy way to find out which of the two histories is accurate. Like if you control a lot of nodes in a network, for example, you can convince the whole network that your history is accurate. And I mean, I hope to publish a piece very soon, like today or tomorrow, which speaks also to just the name proof of stake, because you have to give it to the shitcoiners that they are very smart when it comes to riding the coattails of Bitcoin, because Bitcoin introduced proof of work. Adam Beck invented proof of work for Hashcash, so it was an anti-spam mechanism. And if you study the prehistory of Bitcoin, it becomes very apparent that this is a very new and ingenious thing that, like, the thing about digital information is there is no cost to copying digital information. This is true for Bitcoin too. Like you can copy everything in Bitcoin at no cost. Like I can copy your private key, for example. If I know it, I have it. I can copy the Bitcoin code. I can copy every single block. Everything is just information. And the thing about the information is that you can copy it perfectly at zero cost, basically. Like if you can read the information, you can copy it. This is always true. And so what proof of work does is it creates in the digital realm something that Nick Szabo called unforgeable costliness, which is something where you can prove, but just by looking at it, that it took a lot of resources to create this thing. And that's why a lot of people that write about proof of work, they bring up the Egyptian pyramids, for example, because it's the same thing. You look at the Egyptian pyramids and you can immediately tell, like even without knowing anything about them, you can tell it took a lot of effort to create this. And this is true also for great art, you know, like if you look at Michelangelo or what have you, like there are some statues out of marble. You look at the marble statue and it's apparent that like you don't have to know anything about it, but you know a lot of work went into this. And proof of work is like that, but for the digital domain. And so what the shitcoins did is they took the term proof of work and they came up with something else, which is how the fiat system currently works. You know, it's just like, hey, trust me, bro, everything's good. You just trust me and I'll tell you what happened. And they call it proof of stake. And I mean, there's also, you know, there's delegated proof of stake, and there's proof of space, and there's proof of space time, and there's proof of burn, and there's proof of 10 or 20 different other things. And it sounds like there are these 15 different consensus mechanisms, and they all start with proof of, but they're all the same, and they're all as good as proof of work, which is complete nonsense. There's only proof of work, and it's the only thing that works. And everything else is complete bullshit. And the piece I'm going to publish very soon, it is about the linguistic attacks on Bitcoin. And I consider this a linguistic attack as well, because it's like, it sounds as if it's the same thing, you know, proof of work and proof of stake, but it is completely different. And that's also why I wrote Bitcoin is Time, because you have to understand the problems the proof of work solves to understand why proof of stake is so different and the non-solution to start with. There's also like, there's no single proof of stake coin, for example, that solves the problem of issuance. How do you issue new tokens fairly across all participants, across the system? There can't be an authority. If you have an authority that issues it, it's already a centralized system. If there is one person or one party or one team that tells, you know, that scans the eyeballs of every person on earth and gives them, I don't know, like the the appropriate amount of how many people are currently alive, that's already a centralized entity. So it's a non-starter. And proof of work solves the issuance problem as well. And it does so by utilizing time. So the way I explain it sometimes is that all Bitcoins already exist. All 21 million Bitcoins already exist, and they are hidden in mathematical space. And what Bitcoin miners do is just they try to discover the Bitcoin. They dig it out of the mathematical ground. And you can see that this is true because it doesn't matter how much energy you use for mining. It doesn't matter how hard you dig. You don't create more Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin is fixed already, and it's fixed in time. And that's also why we know approximately in the year 2140, the last Bitcoin will be mined. And mining is like it's a little bit of a misnomer, because mining kind of will continue. You know, it's the process which uses energy to secure the network will continue. It's just that the additional reward of new Bitcoin will stop. And all these things are only possible because of proof of work. And all these things are also only possible because of the difficulty adjustment. And the energy usage of Bitcoin is required to create the system in a way so that you don't need a trusted third party, and that you have like a history that is truthful and that doesn't require any entity to kind of sign off on the truthfulness. The truthfulness is apparent in the data, in the history itself. You just look at the numbers, you look at the data, and you can see this is actually what happened in the system. This is actually what happened in the real world. And that's why it's so powerful. And again, like, it's only proof of work matters, and only proof of work is a true consensus mechanism. Everything else is basically a scam.
The thing that I wanted to, just add and ask you about was, your conception of your idea of integrating time and Bitcoin, and also looking at, Bitcoin as a living organism, Bitcoin as time, all from a physics point of view, right? I mean, you talk about thermodynamics, and then you also talk a lot about Bitcoin as time. I think you also mentioned a book called, I think it's called The Order of Time. I don't know when you mentioned about it. It's in one of your tweets or something. And so can you talk a little more also about the aspect of Bitcoin as time? Like, why did you started approaching these things? Was it an analogy that you tried to build, or was it something that just came out naturally? You're like sitting and thinking, oh, this is true. Or like, how do you come about with this thing?
It was basically the latter, which was like, oh shit, this is true. This is actually how Bitcoin works. It creates its own time. And it's, I mean, I'm not the only one. Like, these are not my original ideas. I maybe dug a little bit deeper than some other people. But the first person, for example, who mentioned that Bitcoin is a living organism was Ralph Merkle, who invented the Merkle trees. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a paper actually on DAOs, so on decentralized autonomous organizations, which kind of have a very bad reputation because the very first big DAO on Ethereum failed. And basically, in my opinion, destroyed Ethereum because they bailed out everyone who was mm-hmm. participating in the DAO, and that's how Ethereum split in Ethereum Classic and just the Ethereum that we know now. And in my opinion, the bailout was a complete disaster because it showed that, Cody's law is not actually true. In the end, there are a couple of people in Ethereum that can change everything if shit hits the fan, and that's what they did. And that's why also Bitcoin is very different, because the attacks that happened in Bitcoin always prevailed. And that was like the first big problem in Ethereum, and Ethereum completely failed. So that's why those two are very different. But to answer your question in regards to these analogies and how I came up with them, the honest answer is I didn't. So Ralph Merkle was the first one with the biological organism, and then Brandon Quidham came along mm-hmm. and he took up this metaphor and he compared Bitcoin to mycelium. Mm-hmm. And he also was not the first one to do this, because there's a very old Bitcoin wallet which is called Mycelium, for example. And I mean, people obviously were thinking about those things and had similar ideas. And it is a networked thing. And so what is networked in nature? So there are some networked organisms, and mushrooms are like the mycelial networks of mushrooms are a perfect example of networked organisms. And if you study networks, if you study all kinds of networks, it doesn't matter if it's traffic networks or like water networks, many, many things in nature behave in a very similar way because they're networked, and all networks kind of need to do the same thing. So they need to, with mycelium, for example, you need to transport, all networks need to transport certain things, and all networks consist of nodes that have to talk to each other. And so if it's about passing nutrients and bringing nutrients to the right places, or in Bitcoin, it's about value and bringing value to the right places. With the internet, it's about information and bringing information to the right places. With streets and trains and all the rest of it, it's about bringing people and goods to the right places. And so they're all very similar phenomena, and that's also why they work in a very similar way. That's also why this biology metaphor is very useful for understanding Bitcoin, because if you understand one of these networks deeply, then you can, like, they all work very similarly, and then you can understand how resilient Bitcoin is. For example, the internet was built to survive nuclear war, basically. I mean, the internet came out of DARPA and of US military research, and it was basically like, how can we build up a communication network that even if half of it gets destroyed, that we can still communicate with each other and agree on the next tactical move and those kind of things. And that's also the quote that Ralph Merkel had. He realized that Bitcoin basically pays us, it pays miners to keep it alive. And so even if nuclear war destroyed half of the planet, Bitcoin would, march on unhindered, and it would still produce new blocks, and the difficulty adjustment takes care of the rest. So the difficulty adjustment, basically, whatever happens in the real world, Bitcoin will know about this just through the difficulty adjustment alone. It's like a thermostat, and then it regulates itself, and then it is just like nothing happened. And we see this with the China exodus, like when China banned mining, and more than more than half of the network hash rate left in like the same week, and it didn't really matter, Bitcoin. Roughly every 10 minutes, a new block came in, and difficulty adjusted down, and the miners were plugged in some other jurisdiction, and some are still mining underground in China. And it helps to have this biology metaphor in your head, because any networked organism also works like this. If you cut it in half, it will just, grow again, and it will grow around the obstacle, and it will if there is no head to cut off, then something is very, very hard to kill. And with the time stuff, there was a guy, I can never pronounce his name, Gregory Trubetskoy or something like that. I have no idea where he comes from. It sounds very Russian. But he wrote Bitcoin is a decentralized clock. Like, that was one of the articles that just blew my mind. And he went kind of deep, but in my opinion, not deep enough, in the sense that he explained that Bitcoin is a decentralized clock, but he didn't explain the why behind it. Like, why do you need a decentralized clock in the first place? And it's what I think is so interesting, and now finally physicists are kind of beginning to pick up on it, in part also because of Dhruv Bansal, who wrote Bitcoin Astronomy, and who is a physicist and has some physicist friends. It's because of relativity. We have no simultaneous events in our universe, and also not on Earth. On Earth, it doesn't feel like this because Earth is very small in the grand scheme of things. Like, the speed of light is very, very high. So it feels as if we have simultaneous events in the universe, because we're all living on Earth, and that's what we know. But we actually don't. And so in like a window of 50 milliseconds, because from one point of the Earth to the other, it takes light 50 milliseconds to travel. And so in this window of 50 milliseconds, you cannot determine what happened first. And this is very, very important, because let's say you broadcast two transactions at the same time in a global network, or you find two blocks at the same time. You cannot say which one came first. It's impossible. It's physically impossible. It, depending on the observer, the first block, like block A, came first. And if you're another observer traveling at a different speed, for example, then block B came first, and both are correct. Like, there is no way, because there are no simultaneous events in the universe, there is no correct answer. Like, depending on where you are in the universe and how fast you're moving, depending on your own space-time, for one observer, A happened before B, and for the other observer, B happened before A. And that's why in every consensus system, in every network, if you need to take the state of the whole network and agree on the state in the whole network, you will always have this limitation. You cannot have a complete agreement. You just can't. And that's why Bitcoin needs to create its own era of time. And what Bitcoin does is it slows down time. So it has these ticks, just like in a computer game, in a computer simulation, where, like, you have Super Mario World, and it renders the whole world in one frame. And then you have a tick, and the next frame, it updates the whole world. And that's how Bitcoin works as well. And every single tick is 10 minutes. Like, every new block is a new tick. And this is enough to make sure that even with relativistic effects, and even with like delays of routers and communication delays and so on, the whole network that is earthbound can agree on one single state. And that's also like, Bitcoin will remain Earthcoin. Like, Bitcoin can't work in the whole solar system, for example, let alone the whole galaxy. So Bitcoin as long as the center of Hash Horizon remains on Earth, Bitcoin will also remain on Earth. You can't really use it in a meaningful way outside. I mean, of course, you can't do Lightning and so on and so forth. But to do settlement and to really use Bitcoin, you have to stay close to the Hash Horizon.
Yeah, but what if we... I'm not suggesting change in Bitcoin protocol consensus parameters, but what if we change the time from like 10 minutes to like 20 minutes? Can it work between Earth and Moon? Just curious.
Yeah. Earth and Moon is enough. It also works for 10 minutes. So
okay.
I think time from Earth to the Moon, like in light speed, is like 8 seconds or something. I don't know. I have no idea if that's right, but I think it's something like that. And I think to Mars, it's like 7 minutes or something like that. So with 20 minutes, we could do some planets, maybe. But it it all depends on where you're mining. So if you're mining on Mars, then the thing is that there are no solutions to this problem. There are only trade-offs. And so some, for example, if the block time is way lower, for example, again, as I said, it takes 50 milliseconds on Earth from the one side of the Earth to the other one. So if it's below 50 milliseconds, consensus will become impossible because you just will never be able to agree on anything. If it's like 2 seconds or something, you will have conflicting histories all the time. And we see this actually, that's called orphan blocks. And we see this with some of the shitcoins that have we have so many transactions because we reduced the block time to, I don't know, like 10 seconds or something. They have a lot of conflicting histories. And it's very hard to do Nakamoto consensus there because you have to keep mining on all the histories because every history is similarly valid. And the way that Nakamoto consensus works is that the heaviest chain wins, and it's a probabilistic conflict resolution. And that's also why Bitcoin is so important, because it's usually, if we have any conflict about who owes what to whom, like who owns this thing, in the end, you'll ask a judge, and then you'll have a jury, and then you'll have police. And we always resolve this with violence, and we have to resolve it with violence. And Bitcoin is the only thing that can do conflict resolution when it comes to property in a peaceful manner, because it does it automatically, and it does it probabilistically, and it does it only by sending around messages. It only sends around numbers and messages. It only speaks words. It only is text. You know, everything in Bitcoin is text. All of Bitcoin is text all the time. And so Bitcoin is like this language game that sets up these rules. And if there is a conflict in regards to like who owns what, Bitcoin will resolve this conflict by itself in a probabilistic fashion. And the longer the block time is and the more hash rate you have, the less conflicts you will run into. So there's only these trade-offs. And if you want to, for example, create a coin that works across the solar system, you will have to increase the block time by a lot, like, you know, many hours, maybe even days, depending on where you're mining and so on. If you want to do the galaxy, for example, the Milky Way galaxy, the light diameter of the whole Milky Way galaxy is like 200,000 light years. Mm-hmm. So if you want to do it in the whole galaxy, if you want to do galaxy coin, you need a block time of at least 200,000 years. So it's not very useful, you know. So it's like you have these very real physical limits, and you kind of need to find, like, you need to find a trade-off between final settlement, which is complete agreement across the whole system, and how long it takes to reach this agreement. And with Bitcoin, 10 minutes, it's perfect for Earth, basically.
Sounds good. Yeah, I haven't really thought about like expanding out of Earth, and I think the thought of Bitcoin is Earthcoin. It's interesting. Think more about it.
Yeah, you should definitely read Ruf Bansal's piece, Bitcoin Astronomy. He goes into great detail there. I'll send it to you.
Sounds good. Yeah, speaking of hash rate, the more the hash rate, the more secure Bitcoin is. The way I see it, hash rate is a sort of a defense mechanism for Bitcoin. And the way I came to know was through your thoughts and writings. But there is an opposite kind of thought where hash rate is sort of war and violence, like projecting power. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So I don't think there are many people talking about this. I think Jason Lowry is basically the only person who makes this comparison. And he's not... Not really. He's not the only one. He's also not the first one. Adam Gibson, who did a lot of work in the privacy realm, he talked about this as well. Some other people made comparisons to, you know, how the fiat system secures itself with warships and so on. Like aircraft carriers are basically the full nodes of the fiat system. And there is also Eric Kaysen, which I adore him. He's one of the deepest thinkers in Bitcoin, as far as I'm concerned, from the philosophical side of things. He also talks about how cryptography is warlike in the sense that it is a weapon, and it needs to be wielded correctly and carefully, and it can be used. Even Hal Finney talked about this, that strong cryptography can be used to liberate the individual, but it can also be used to enslave the individual. You know, like you can use it for good and for bad and so on. And so these ideas have been around, but what Jason is, I'm not sure what Jason is trying to do. It all, again, coming back to linguistic attacks, I feel like calling Bitcoin a weapon, it's not only a stretch, it's very disingenuous. Because then if Bitcoin is a weapon, then correspondence chess is a weapon. Because Bitcoin works just like correspondence chess. So if you're playing chess with someone and you don't know who this person is, and he uses like an anonymous mail-in box, and you say, you know, like pawn to c4 as your opening move or whatever, and you're not wielding a weapon. Like you're playing a game and you're using language to express the moves of the game. And this is how Bitcoin works as well. So it is very disingenuous to call anything of that sort a weapon. If Bitcoin is anything, Bitcoin is a shield. And Jason wrote this long, it's not even that long, but he wrote an essay that is titled Want to Understand Bitcoin, Understand War. And I agree with a lot of the things that he says in the sense of kind of, why do nation states even exist? Why do we have wars in the first place? And it's about, it's about property rights. It's about who has access to resources, who owns what. And if you want to take something from someone else, you do it violently, basically. Between nation states, I mean, it all breaks down to, he has this very, very long thesis of starting from the biological realm that, you know, every organism needs energy to survive, and you can either defend yourself or attack. It's all a form of power projection, and if I'm bigger than you, then I can eat you, and if I have a big shield, then maybe you cannot eat me, and so on. And all of that is true, kind of. The thing that he leaves out is there are a lot of symbiotic relationships. Like, he never talks about this at all. It's not all war all the time. It just isn't. Also not in nature. There's a lot of symbiosis going on, where you have, not everything is a zero-sum game. You have win-win-win situations where it's good for you, it's good for the other organism, and it's good for the ecosystem at large. And these are the best situations that you want to have. And this is also what markets enable, for example. If you're trading peacefully with someone else, then it's a win-win-win situation. It's like you are giving someone else something that you don't need. You're receiving something that you need in turn, and everyone is better off for it. And if you specialize and so on and so forth, like, humanity will be better for it as well. Like, he leaves this out completely. So this is already, his whole thesis is already incomplete. It's still, you know, like, again, I agree with most of what he's saying. But I completely disagree with his conclusion. And he kind of says that he's doing all of this because, you know, the US Space Force needs a hash force, and he wants to get the military into mining and so on. and war is the only language that they understand and so on. But it's, I don't know. I'm not sure if this is true. You know, it's all very spooky to me. So I don't trust his reasoning there. Maybe his intentions are different, because we went through this before. That's the problem that I have with it, is that if you classify cryptography as a weapon, then you need a license to run a cryptographic algorithm, or you're completely forbidden to do so as an individual. And this is what we call the crypto wars. And it was about RSA and strong encryption. And Adam Beck was played a part in this. So he was the one who put the Perl code on the t-shirts and, you know, printed those t-shirts. And in the end, the war was won in Supreme Court with the because it was in direct conflict with the First Amendment rights of the United States, because in the end, code of speech and what they did is they took the the code that was classified as a weapon, it was classified as a ammunition. So it was basically like an atomic bomb, you know, and you were not allowed to run this algorithm on any computer that you own because you were actually, you know, like using an atomic bomb. And if you were, would send it to someone else, then you were exporting ammunition and all this nonsense. And so they showed that this is nonsense by printing it into a book, sending the book somewhere else outside of the US, exporting ammunition, quote unquote, but just by sending a book. And at the other side, they scanned in the book and they had the algorithm again. And that was the end of it. So in the end, the legal system had to accept that either this law is stupid or the First Amendment needs to fall. And I think with Bitcoin, it's exactly the same. Bitcoin is all text all the time. And you could, like, you can send a Bitcoin transaction by printing it into a book. You can also, you know, find a minor valid Bitcoin block and print it out and send it somewhere, send it to the network. And it's all text. So the same argument applies. And that's why I don't trust kind of Jason's argumentation and the fact that he's from the military and tries to push the narrative that Bitcoin is a weapon and Bitcoin is war. And it all sounds very fishy to me, because if he kind of gets his way and everyone agrees, then ASICs, like he, for example, he held up a gun and an ASIC in front of the webcam and says, these things are equivalent. And that's just not true. You know, that is just not true. You don't need a weapons license to use an ASIC. An ASIC is just doing math very quickly. And so my kind of counter argument to this is I wrote a thread that's called "Want to Understand Bitcoin, Understand Peace." And so I go into all the detail of how Bitcoin is about nonviolent conflict resolution and how it's not warlike, it's speech-like, and it's like a game, and it's about kind of bringing into existence inalienable property rights. And this is something that's very, very new, because it used to be that, again, like, if I can eat you, I will eat you. If I have the longer stick, then I can beat you and I can just take your stuff away. And Bitcoin is very different, because you cannot take away someone's Bitcoin. If like, I always like to use the stupid kind of example, because you should not do this. Brain wallets are not safe. Like, but it works with multisig and so on as well. But just to illustrate the point, you can't store Bitcoin in your head by remembering 12 words. And if you have 12 words in your head and no other copy of your private key, you are your Bitcoin. You have the Bitcoin in your brain. And no one can take it away from you. Like, it doesn't matter how much you beat me. It doesn't matter what you do. I mean, you can probably drag me up and try to get it out this way. But you cannot simply take it away from me. You know, like, it's very, very different. So Bitcoin is the only thing that can't be stolen from you. It's like a secret, because holding Bitcoin is knowing a secret. And that's why it's so very different. And this is also why it's not war. You know, it just isn't. There is no way to violently take it away from you. That just is not. And that's why the war metaphor falls down completely. And that's also why Adam Beck said, it's like, if you want to use the war metaphor, if you want to use the language of war, then Bitcoin is like a nuclear-proof personal shield, like a force field that every single individual can, you know, put on. And then you have this impenetrable force field around you. Because the thing about strong cryptography is that no matter who attacks it, like, China can, you know, cooperate with Russia and become allies with the US just to attack you and just to try to brute force your private key, and they won't succeed. Like, the three biggest standing armies of the world have no chance of breaking the strong cryptography that you use to use Bitcoin. And that's why it's like this force field. It's a shield that can't be broken by anyone. And that's also what makes it so powerful. And that's why it empowers the individual.
Totally agree. I can see where Jason is seeing that from. Like, I see the military as like a wave power projection. Reasons more for like defense mechanism. Like, militaries are created for mainly to showcase, hey, I have this much energy, I have this much resources, and this is what I'm capable of doing. Do not touch me. I see even space programs as like that. Okay, we can send people to the moon. You cannot. And that's a way of power projection. And I can totally see where Jason is coming from, but. Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah. No, I to be fair, like, I think his thesis, it is very good, and the argument he makes is also very good, and he's a very smart guy. You know, that's also in part why I don't trust him. Like, usually the very smart guys they have hidden agendas or something. But it's like, I agree with like 95% or so of what he's saying. I just don't agree with the conclusion. I don't agree with his motivation. It's most of the things he says is correct. It's for example, that like if you want to call everything about ownership a ledger and keeping the ledger intact, historically we always had to use violence and we had to use war for this. And even if you don't see it, but the fact that I own my house, for example, and I'm in the registry that gives the property title to me and so on. If there is a dispute, we go to a judge and so on and so forth. And there's always violence behind it. There's always the violence of the state behind it. And so all of this is true. And he also says that Bitcoin is the continuation of that by other means, kind of. And I also agree with that, but it's by peaceful means. And it's like all of that is true, but it is now very different and it's not war anymore. You know, it's not weapons anymore. It's not blood. Like, and he says that hashing is violence, for example. That's such a stretch, you know. And I got into many arguments on Twitter, and I was like, okay, so if everything is a weapon, and if a shield is a weapon, which is still, you know, maybe kind of correct, then a wall is also a weapon. Are the walls of my house a weapon? Well, you know, and people said yes, you know, and then I'm like, okay, what are we even talking about? You know, like words lose all meaning if you make these arguments.
Did you get blocked eventually, or it's?
Like... Oh yeah, I got blocked. I got blocked and unblocked and blocked again. So I don't know my current state, but he that's also something like if you can't take criticism, you shouldn't kind of well, like if you're trying to build up a thesis, at least take the criticism. You know, like a lot of people had very valid criticism against him, and he just basically blocked them all. So well, I don't know.
Blocking is a weapon, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely.
I just wanted to pick your brains on, you speak a lot about value for value model, predominantly podcasting 2.0. I think that was championed by Adam Curry. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about what value for value is, the sort of how it changes the way products are monetized currently? How does it change things?
Yeah, of course. So I wrote this long piece, which is called The Freedom of Value. And it goes into kind of the problems that we currently have, I think, online. I mean, we all know the internet isn't perfect and the world has many problems as always. So there is a lot to complain about. But before Bitcoin came along, there was never like a viable solution to not only solving the tragedy of the commons, but basically selling pure information itself. Like I mentioned before that I was very interested in, you know, torrents and torrenting all kinds of things. Like even before torrents were a thing, there was, you know, Napster and LimeWire and I don't know what, like there were so many different things. Mm-hmm. And that's also very instructive. I think Bitcoiners can learn a lot from the history of file sharing, because torrents are still around, and it's the only thing that has no head to cut off, you know, and every other protocol had some central entity that could be, you know, subpoenaed or just destroyed in some way. And so all other approaches failed, and then BitTorrent came along, and BitTorrent still lives and still succeeds. And I think Bitcoin is very similar, that all other approaches before it had a central point of failure, and all other, like BitGold and I don't know, like that's not even the proper name. What was it called?
Hashcash?
Maybe.
No.
there were a bunch that failed. Yeah. E-gold was it, right? Yeah. And so all the approaches to try to do digital trustless money kind of, or digital cash, failed. And to me, it was very clear early on that information should be free and information wants to be free. So if you have like a song and MP3, you know, why sell it like a CD? You know, I understand the selling of a CD, because you have to, CDs are scarce. You need to create the CD, you need to produce it, you need to ship it, and so on and so forth. Like there are some costs involved, and you know, there's a margin with that you can put on that, and like that makes all the sense in the world. But selling an MP3 file, like seriously, like it doesn't make any sense. So kind of it dawned on me very, very early. I had no solution, but I was just like, this shit should be free all the time. And I mean, it also kind of was with torrents, and it still kind of is. And I mean, we're now in a world where academic papers, for example, which are just PDFs, they will cost you like $40 or $60 or $90 to download. I mean, that's so ridiculous. It's so backwards and it's so broken. And so I think that the failure to monetize information led to a lot of problems that we currently have online, because the way that information is monetized now, today, mostly, is by doing surveillance on the users. And gathering as much data as you can and selling this data to advertisers and to surveillance firms and to governments and to whatnot, like to the highest bidder, basically. And that's how Facebook makes their billions, and that's how Google makes their billions, and that's how everyone makes their billions. That's, there's a reason why they say data is the new oil and all the rest of it. And so, of course, that's terrible for society, that's terrible for privacy, that's terrible for the users. I would even argue it's terrible for the companies, because it incentivizes you to not focus on your product and not focus on your service, but it incentivizes you to focus on how much data can I extract from my users? How can I spy on the users a little bit more in a little bit more ingenious way to extract even more data out of them? And how, and then also, you know, like, again, you will sell this data to the highest bidder. The highest bidders will be very bad people, you know, kind of by default, you know. And so the fact that microtransactions didn't work online because of just the overhead of the fiat layered system that you had to do. Like, you can't use a credit card for like a 5-cent payment. It just doesn't work. Like, the fees will make it infeasible. Ah, sorry, I shouldn't have eaten those nuts. So the thing is that now we can't do micropayments, and we still have the problem that information wants to be free and the paywalls do not work. And the I called this in the article. I identified two things: the MTX problem and the DRM paradox. And the MTX problem, it's short for mental transaction costs. And the thing about micropayments is, if you have to make a conscious decision, do I want to spend like 2 cents on this MP3 file or on this PDF or whatever, you would probably not spend it. It's just the mental burden of having to think about it is too much. It's you know, like a pop-up or what have you, or it's, there are many, yeah, many such things where, or like you, a good example is also, at least this happens to me. I don't know if it happens to you guys, but if I, on all my devices, everywhere I do, I have ad blockers absolutely everywhere. And so if I want to watch a 5-second YouTube clip, then I will open it up and no ad will come, and then I'll watch it and that's it. But on some other computers or on some other devices, if I want to watch a 5-second YouTube clip, then like a 7-second or 2-second advertisement comes before it. I'm not even interested in the 5-second YouTube clip anymore. I will just close the tab as fast as this fucking advertisement comes up. And so this is related to the mental transaction cost thing, where if you have to think about it, that's already way too annoying and you won't make the buying decision. And all the people that study this, they know this. That's also why Netflix has a subscription. And, you know, like every single thing has a subscription. Like, yeah. Spotify has a subscription, and Hulu has a subscription, and Disney Plus has a subscription, and Amazon Prime has a subscription. And now you have this subscription zoo of like 25 different services that you kind of need to have or want to have, because everyone knows that paying for the item directly doesn't work. You have to get people to subscribe to it, and people are willing to subscribe to it. Then you make the purchasing decision one time and you never have to think about it again. And so that's one thing that you have to kind of keep in mind when we are talking about solving the problem of selling information online, selling something like a PDF or like a blog post or like an MP3 and so on. Like, you have to solve this problem as well. But the second problem is the DRM paradox, which is digital rights management, which doesn't work. Like, it's, if you want to, I mean, you can still pirate every single album and movie that's worth pirating. And the DRM paradox is like, it's a paradox because only shitty content will stay behind paywalls. And like, only the shittiest of films are the ones that you can torrent, because no one sees them. No one is interested in them. And then you'll have to buy it somewhere. You'll have to get the fucking DVD from somewhere. I don't know what. And it's the same for a blog post. Like, if the blog post is actually good and worth reading, you will find like a screenshot on social media of the whole thing, or someone will copy paste it somewhere, or someone, like, it's very easy to set content free because only one person has to crush the paywall by paying for it and spend the like 20 cents. And then you can just self-host it somewhere and everyone gets it for free. And that's why DRM doesn't work ever. Like, it can't work. It's so, paywalls are so insanely stupid. It amazes me that Bitcoiners still want to do paywalls, and there are now Lightning paywalls and so on. It's so stupid. Like, I hate it so much. And also, one of the first uses of Bitcoin was for paywalls, and it never caught on, because it's just, okay, then someone, either you don't pay for it because you you don't think it's worth it, or you pay for it once and then you set it free and no one will, you know, use the paywall version. So that's just what's going on. And that was a very long rant intro into value for value, because value for value solves both of these problems. And value for value kind of puts the whole model of paying for information on its head. It does not put information behind bars. It sets information free from the get-go. Like the first implementation of the value for value model was done with podcasting 2.0. And as you mentioned, Adam Curry championed this. And the way it works is that you can try it out yourself. Like if your listeners don't know, you probably spoke about it, but it's still worth mentioning. Newpodcastapps.com. There you have a list of podcast apps that implemented this. And the way this works is your podcast player has a Bitcoin wallet integrated in it, and it's a Lightning wallet. And you can just, very much like a, you know, a Netflix subscription, you have to make one decision. And I mean, there are some defaults as well, but you just have to decide how much do I want to spend per minute, or like you can also calculate yourself like approximately per episode or per week or what have you. So you set yourself an allowance, and everything else, the micropayments work in the background. And with every minute that you listen to a podcast, you make a micropayment to whoever is behind the podcast. And because Bitcoin is programmable money, you can program this in a very fine-grained way that, for example, you know, the guy who does the intro music gets like 5%, and maybe, you know, some Bitcoin open source developer gets like 10%, and the podcast host gets 50%, and the guest gets the rest. And some people now even integrate it with, you know, like there is a messaging system built in this as well, where you can integrate small messages, small text messages into the Lightning payments, and it's called boostergrams. And so you can boost, you can think of it like clapping. If you like something very much, you clap, you boost it, and you can send a small message to the podcast host as well. And so people, it's a very new way of consuming content and interacting with the audience. And then people sometimes source questions from the boostergrams. And if they know who asked the question, they will include it. They will include the person who asked it in the next split, like if the question was good, you know? And so all these new kind of cool, beautiful things are emerging. And it's all completely voluntary. It's just a regular podcast. You can listen to it with an old podcast app and not pay anything for it. You can also set the amounts all to zero in the Lightning-enabled podcasting apps. It's all voluntary. And so you don't have to pay for it, but you can. And that's why I, when I wrote about it, I brought up the example of street performers, of busking, where you have a street performer, you can watch it. You can watch for free. Everyone can watch. But everyone also knows, like, there's a hat on the ground. And if you want the music to continue, you will have to throw in some coins from time to time. You know, like if everyone is free riding all the time, the music will stop. And so it's a very honest monetization model. It's a very honest kind of relationship between the people who produce the information and the people who consume the information. And I always like to give this example. Like I convinced a friend of mine who made an awesome movie about Bitcoin and about Bitcoiners. It's called Human Bee. It's a German movie, but there are English subtitles. So you can watch it, even though you won't understand the thing. But it's a great movie. It's very, very well produced and very well shot. I'm in it as well. And so they basically interviewed five or six different Bitcoiners and showed the human side of Bitcoin. And I convinced him to run the whole movie on a value for value basis. And so it's available for free online. And so it not only works for podcasts, it works for movies as well. And he was basically like, just at the end of the movie, explaining, yeah, this, you know, go to this site to throw in some coins if you enjoyed the movie. If not, it's fine too. And, you know, someone gave a whole Bitcoin. And that's why my the article where I go into some detail of all of these thoughts is called the freedom of value, because usually how you pay for something is either by the hour or per item. For digital information, this doesn't make any sense. Like per item doesn't make any sense. And so in the value for value model, you have no upper limit of how much people, how much value was produced for the people that consumed it. So you have to decide for yourself, as someone who just watched the movie or listened to the episode or read the blog post or read the book or whatever, how much was this worth to you? And Adam Curry talks about this beautifully all the time. He's like, okay, was this like the last 3 hours you listened to the podcast? Was this as valuable as like watching a movie? And the movie is like, you know, $25, $50, depending on how much popcorn and soft drinks you you eat. And so some people give $20, some people give $50. Some people truly only make a micropayment and give, like, you know, 200 satoshis, and that's fine too. But some people are maybe very rich and it changed their life, and yeah, they will give like one whole Bitcoin or what have you. And it's all kinds of amazing, I think. Because the advertisement industry is so broken and so disingenuous and also so big, I think the value for value model can really turn the whole thing on its head, and kind of, there's so much potential there to really have an alternative to all the data gathering and the spying on people and the disingenuous way of making money. But I also think that because it's so early, like, most people don't know this exists, and most people have no idea about Bitcoin and sats and streaming money and so on, it will take a good while until we figure out how to talk about this, how to think about this, how to use it, how to actually make a meaningful amount of money with it and so on. I mean, it took YouTubers a long time. Like, it took, I don't know, probably like 10 years until something like a full-time YouTuber existed, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think it will take also a couple of years until we have the first, 1,000 people or so who are full-time value for value podcasters or content producers. We'll see.
Yeah, the current product space is all filled with like dark patterns. Yeah. If you learn about like Facebook Pixel, the Pixel project, like they track pixels from other websites.
It's so bad.
It's so bad.
Don't look into it. You'll just get depressed.
And yeah, I don't know if it relates to value for value, but the idea is to at least you voluntarily pay it to the creators and it goes to the creator. There's one more, I don't know what to call it, but there's one more thing that people are trying to make sure the content creators are paid, which is the NFT movement. What are your thoughts on that? What are your thoughts on that, and how can value for value sort of break that? whatever you want to call it. I don't know
what to think about it. I mean,
like Jack Dorsey, he says like the idea behind NFT is correct, which I kind of agree. Like, the artists need to be, it's a bad world out there for artists. Label companies take majority of the stake. They want to be paid directly.
Yeah,
I believe value for value can break it, but what are your thoughts on that?
I don't know. It's probably way, way, way easier to make $1 million with like an NFT sale than it is with value for value. So it's just not, I mean, I really don't like NFTs for many reasons. I think people misunderstand what NFTs are. I think even people creating NFTs and working in the NFT space understand what NFTs are and what they can actually do. And also from an economic perspective, how stupid they are. I always like to say that an NFT is a shitcoin with an issuance of one. So it doesn't make any sense to hold it. And the people that... Also, we went through this before, like in the Bitcoin world, NFTs existed in the forms of colored coins and rare peppers for a long time, like as far back as like 2014, I think. And they always kind of go to zero because, well, it's a shitcoin with an issuance of one. So when compared to Bitcoin, they always go to zero in Bitcoin terms. It's people think that they are buying the art, you know? That's my biggest problem with NFTs is that they are marketed in this way that people truly believe that they are owning a JPEG, you know, and that they are owning, I don't know, like a music file or what have you. And that's just stupid. Like, you don't, as we said before, if you can read the value, if you can read the information, you can copy it perfectly. And that's also why, you know, the main criticism against NFTs is like right click save. You know, someone has an NFT profile picture and then, yeah, I can just right click save it. And it doesn't even matter if, you know, like, on Twitter, it's displayed as a hexagon or so. If you actually have it on OpenSea, which of course OpenSea is a centralized platform, because first of all, you can fake it. You can make it so that it looks like this hexagonal shape, what a lot of people do. And also, who tells you? You know, like there's so many things wrong with it. It's like we see this already. You know, like where you right click save the NFT and then you put it on some other chain because there's like 10,000 different NFT chains. And so, okay, who owns it? Like who was the first one? Is the one who was first the creator? And you also have, you know, so many people that just rip off artists. So artists put out their art online, and then some NFT creator right click saves it and puts it online as an NFT and sells it for like $500,000. And so it's just scams all the way down. NFTs are truly scams all the way down. And it's just trying to print your own money. And it's money in the forms of these tokens that are related to, you know, ape JPEGs and whatnot. So it's all kinds of stupid. I don't think it solves the problems for artists truly. I think it will go away just like the ICO boom went away.
I really hope it dies in this cycle. There's also some things that Vitalik Buterin is bringing. It's called soulbound tokens. I have no idea what those are. I hope it dies part of this cycle as well.
I only heard the phrase, but I tried to look into it, and then I just thought like, oh, it's so stupid. Why am I wasting my time? And I closed the tab.
In that way, they're like Vitalik Buterin and the clan. They're really clever. Like, they come up with clever names.
Yeah, of course.
And they come up with clever names, like you called it, like linguistic attacks on Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's all fancy words, and no one really knows what it is or how it works, but it sounds really cool, and the marketing is amazing, and the website looks great. And yeah, let's just all get rich and buy some apes. It's so stupid.
Yeah, privacy and freedom. So for those of you who don't know, GG is like focuses a lot on privacy, on OPSEC. Nobody knows how he looks. Although I've met you in person, GG, if you remember back in Bitcoin 20 conference. But it was really hard to find him. He was wearing a hat.
You're leaking his identity, man.
Yeah, I still have the hat.
Yeah, I didn't dox him, but yeah. It was really hard to find who Gigi was. I really don't know if I met Gigi, because some people think it's just a robot with floating headphones and and sunglasses. But yeah, back to the topic. Like, you really focus on privacy, and you also talk about privacy and freedom are sides of the same coin, or same sides of a coin, sorry. Yeah, do you want to talk about both privacy and freedom?
Of course. The whole idea, I mean, it's funny how in the beginning, most people thought that Bitcoin is anonymous because it was used, you know, in darknet markets, the Silk Road and so on. And everyone was like, okay, Bitcoin is this untraceable cyber cash and so on. And now it's the opposite. Now it's like most people are aware that Bitcoin is not perfect in terms of privacy. And they're like, okay, don't use Bitcoin. It's like super traceable and so on. And the truth lies in the middle. And the reason why privacy is important is, and some people, like some of the predecessors of Bitcoin, people that worked on the predecessors of Bitcoin, most notably YDAI with B-Money, he mentioned this very clearly, and he referenced a lot of writing from like the 70s onward, where the first ideas around, where the first people realized that with strong cryptography, you can create identities online that are disconnected from your real government given identity, where you can be a pseudonym online and no one will ever find out who you really are. And it's interesting because, and if someone is interested in that, I can highly recommend a book written by Werner Vinci, which is called True Names. It's a really great book. It was one of the first books that played around with this idea. It's a science fiction book. So if you're into science fiction, it's a good one. And where, like, people use the internet to do all kinds of things and, you know, take over satellites and so on. I mean, I won't spoil it too much, but no one knew who these people were. And part of the game was trying to figure out what the true names of the people were. That's where the title comes from. So the true name is like the government given name, your real, quote unquote, real meat space identity. And so in cyberspace, you don't need to have real identities. And that's also, I use a pseudonym to drive home this point and to get the conversation going about privacy online. Because unfortunately, thanks to Facebook and Google and some other big players, there is a move towards trying to convince people that you need to use your real name online always for absolutely everything, and you only have this one identity. And I just believe that this is terribly wrong and terribly misguided, because I believe that identity is prismatic and you have like five different identities at least. Like, you're a different person when you go to church or when you go to your job or when you go, you know, to the strip club or when you go to soccer practice or what have you. Like, you are many different people in one. Like, that's just the way how humans work and operate, and how it's just a fact of psychology. So trying to force multifaceted people with their prismatic identities into one identity is already a mistake as far as I'm concerned. It's especially if this identity can't be deleted, tracks everything you do all the time. And I mean, we see this already in society. We see this play out, you know, where people lose their jobs because they post the wrong picture on Instagram, because they were partying out with their friends or what have you, or they posted a bikini photo of themselves and they're like a PR person for some big company, and it's just like, you know, in conflict with the company policy and so on. And so I think to have certain freedoms, you need to be careful about your privacy. And the phrase that sums it up best is surveillance makes all other freedoms useless. Because if you know that you're being surveilled all the time, you will behave very differently. And the reason, like, for example, the reason why we have any progress in society is because you can have private conversations and you can go against the status quo by having private conversations with others and kind of think through the current issues that you face in private. If you were not able to do this, the regime that is in power would kill you instantly. You know, that's just like you would have no way of figuring out what to do in the first place or how to improve in the first place. So all of these, that's also why in the Cypherpunk Manifesto, it is written that, you know, privacy is necessary for a society in the electronic age. Because if you have total surveillance online, you can't have any progress. You can't have any meaningful discussions about the issues at hand. Because then, you know, like if you write the wrong thing online and 10 minutes later the police comes knocking to arrest you, then that's not a society anyone wants to live in, I think. And so I truly believe that freedom and privacy are two sides of the same coin. And you should kind of, I think everyone should make an effort of reducing their own online footprint as much as they can. And also, you know, just play around with privacy technologies and play around also with the idea of identity and multiple identities. I think it's very cool and also necessary that we still have the option to, you know, create a NIM on Twitter, for example, and just create a pseudonymous identity to share your thoughts or to create content or what have you. And there's also a reason why artists don't use their real name, for example, and a lot of writers use a pen name. Mm-hmm. You know, like this, these are not new ideas. These are absolutely required for a free society. And it was also, I wrote this piece because I was invited to the Oslo Freedom Forum recently, and I spoke to a lot of activists and dissidents and journalists that would be dead without any privacy. You know, like they have to use encrypted communication. They had to flee the country, for example, or they are reporting in a war zone or what have you. And if they do not take care of their privacy, they don't survive. And so these are very, very extreme examples of how privacy and freedom and also privacy and security are connected. And that was one of the ideas behind it. And the point of the piece was more in a response to the current criticism of that Bitcoin is not private enough. And I go into some detail of how we managed to include end-to-end encryption and HTTPS into the internet. And like 15 years ago, we had like all of the internet was plain text. There was no encryption to speak of. And we managed to do this. And we kind of, as a society, had to learn that this is actually important and it is very dangerous to have everything in plain text all the time. And I think we are still more or less in the plain text phase when it comes to Bitcoin, even though, you know, like we have privacy technologies, it's already way better in Lightning. We have coin joins and we have some other protocol improvements that will improve some of the privacy things kind of by default as well. So it's the first of a series I'm writing on currently. And I hope to highlight some of these things that are in the pipeline. And that, I mean, most of the engineers that are working on Bitcoin are aware of Bitcoin shortcomings and are trying to fix them. But it's also, you know, like the main value proposition of Bitcoin is that it can't be changed willy-nilly. So it will take a long time to fix those kind of things.
That's true.
Yeah, I sort of realized this late in the sense, like, I don't know, do you think it's like a one-way door? Once you expose yourself a little bit, it's going to be hard. Like, I've paid for services to remove all my data off, scrape it off my all data brokers and the internet, but It's a slow process.
Yeah, it definitely is. And also, it really depends on what you want to do and your attack vector and so on. You know, like you have to...
Threat models.
Yeah, exactly. You have to take care of your privacy differently if you're Edward Snowden and currently trying to flee from the NSA headquarters, or if you're just, you know, like a random Bitcoin pleb and maybe, you know, don't want the crazy neighbor to be able to Google everything about you in like 2 minutes. I mean, that's something the Bitcoiners should be aware of. Like, that's maybe also something that can be linked. Jameson Lopp has a long list of physical attacks on Bitcoiners. And Bitcoiners should just be aware to protect their privacy in the sense of like how much Bitcoin are they holding and where do they live and so on. So it's very advisable if you're ordering hardware wallets, for example, or other Bitcoin gear, just use like a postbox or send it to a friend or something. No, don't actually do that. But send it like to a PO box or something that's not associated with your real address. Because there are some crazy and bad people out there, and they just, you know, they're desperate and they will think maybe that you're rich and they will come knocking with a shotgun in their head, in their hand. And so Jameson has this long list, and it shows what kind of things can happen if you don't take this seriously. And again, I think as a Bitcoiner, at least, if it only takes like 30 seconds for me to Google exactly who you are, how much Bitcoin you hold and where you live, that's not a good situation to be in. So maybe you want to improve this. And also just take care of what you post online. A lot of people are still kind of, you know, posting like how much they stacked, for example, or which, you know, it can be good as well. I mean, it can motivate other people, but just make sure to understand what you're about posting and what someone else might be able to gather just from the metadata alone, like how many sets it was, when it was, and so on.
I think we just have a last thing, just as a closing thing. So in the current macro landscape, right, a lot of things are going on. Bitcoin prices like dropping, you know, with the Fed policies and all that. So both from, the current macro landscape point of view, and also from a very technical standpoint, what do you think are the, you know, the biggest threats to Bitcoin? Or do you agree to the fact that Bitcoin is already won? People are just catching up. So,
It's a good question. It's a good question. I'm not sure what the biggest threats are to Bitcoin. I'm, you know, I don't want to risk jinxing it by telling everyone Bitcoin has already won, because I think, I mean, Bitcoin is run by people, basically. And I think maybe apathy is the biggest risk, that people just don't care. And that's also why I think education is so important, and also what you guys are doing is so important, to really talk about these things and encourage people to, you know, don't be afraid of Bitcoin, learn to use it, hold your own keys, all those kind of things. Because if everyone just doesn't care and everyone just has a Coinbase account, we're back to the old system. Then we have like one node, which is Coinbase, and everyone just has a Coinbase account, and we're back to the banking system, and Coinbase can do whatever. And then, you know, everything rests on taking the responsibility of holding your own keys and running your own node and so on. Because if you don't do this, we will have like one mega node and it can change the rules immediately. Then it's like, okay, we suddenly need, you know, 42 million Bitcoin, or why not like 5 billion Bitcoin, or like 21 trillion Bitcoin. That's it all rests on actual users taking the responsibility and taking this kind of stuff seriously. So I guess I'm not too worried about the macro trends. I mean, Bitcoin is obviously still something that people sell if they run out of money. We can see this very clearly, that it's highly correlated. I think most of the sell-offs, though, are happening because of all the crypto nonsense that is... the Ponzi schemes and the house of cards that were built over the last couple of years, and they now come crashing down, and they're all kind of, they have Bitcoin as a collateral, as backstops. And so everything is already crashing, and those kind of Ponzi schemes are forced to sell Bitcoin in an already weak market. So this is, I believe, what dropped us so low, that just all these Ponzi schemes going up in flame, they had to sell all their Bitcoin all the time. Otherwise, things would have been even worse. And in terms of the macro environment, I just hope that I hope it doesn't happen too quickly. So I really hope that just the regular people, the plebs, still have some time to understand it, learn Bitcoin, go on the Bitcoin journey, and just have some time to, you know, inflate the lifeboat, so to speak, and stack some sats and become self-sovereign in their savings and in their money. Because I believe that there is no way out of the mess of that the current central banks have painted themselves into. So there is only basically inflation leading to hyperinflation or a heavy recession or worst of all, stagflation, basically. And it's, I think fiat currencies will continue to fail just like they all failed in the past. Like no fiat currency ever succeeded. The only exception kind of is the US dollar, which has been going more or less strong, depending on your definition of strong, for like 100 years or so. Usually fiat currencies go away after, you know, like it's a ridiculously little time, like 30 years, or maybe that is even too long. But the average lifespan of a fiat currency is nothing. You know, they always go away. And so fiat currencies will fail, just like we see now in Turkey and obviously Venezuela. And there are many examples, mm-hmm. Argentina, where the currencies just fail. And I hope that thanks to, you know, the bottom-up movement that is Bitcoin and the people like you guys that educate their friends and family as best as they can, you know, I mean, at least they know that you're there, even though if they're not listening yet, you know. But I hope that, you know, people will realize that Bitcoin is actually, it is like, everyone thinks that it's speculation and everyone thinks that it is the risky bet, but it is actually the lifeboat, you know. It's, someone said once, I don't remember who it was, but it's a parachute disguised in an adrenaline rush. And so you will have to jump out of the plane, so to speak. But you better have some Bitcoin. You better have the parachute, because it will actually save you. And so I hope that we will still have some time before systemic failure becomes global. And yeah, I'm still hopeful. Like some people that are way smarter than I am think that it doesn't have to be catastrophic, and that because Bitcoin exists, there can be like a graceful transition to a Bitcoin parallel economy, kind of. And yeah, I hope that's true. I hope we still have some time, and I hope that many people see Bitcoin for what it is and will start stacking sats, and yeah, will learn to use Bitcoin in a self-sovereign way and save themselves from the fiat, the fiat downfall that is surely coming.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Thank you.
Yeah. And with respect to, like, I'm just curious from a technical perspective, like not me, but then usually software engineers are like, hey, it's just the software at the end of the day. Could there be like a 0-day attack? Or, and it's software that's running on the internet. Like, mm-hmm. internet is prone to things like BGP attacks. Mm-hmm. Like, you can do attacks on miners. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I see Bitcoin as a higher layer network that is kind of removed from the internet, even though technically it isn't really, but it can use, I mean, you can run Bitcoin purely over Tor, for example. You can also run it over other higher layer anonymous networks like I2P and so on. And we also, like, Bitcoiners are working actively on preemptively building infrastructure that is immune to these attacks. I mean, we have the Blockstream satellite, for example. And so if you're mining out in the desert somewhere, you just need like a satellite dish. And there's also TXTenna, where you can broadcast Bitcoin transactions via radio waves and so on. And all of this works already. So Bitcoin is very resilient when it comes to infrastructure attacks, I believe. And of course, there are always the unknowns, like the 0 days are unknown unknowns. You cannot know if there is a 0 day somewhere. That being said, the cryptographic primitives of Bitcoin are very well understood. And Bitcoin is the biggest honeypot of the world, and the best cryptographers of the world are working on Bitcoin in part. And so we had there were some 0 days on the CPU front not too long ago. There was like Heartbleed, and there was also very recently there was Herzbleed, which is just the German word for heart. And it turns out that the LipsecP library, the main elliptic curve cryptographic library that is used in Bitcoin, was immune to this 0 day attack. It was immune to this cryptographic attack because they did some, like, they kind of preempted this attack. They were like, okay, what if what if there is a zero day, basically, this primitive, then we do it a little bit different, and the zero day cannot exploit the library. And so there are some very smart people just working on Bitcoin and trying to make it as resilient as possible. But of course, you know, there's always, like, nothing is 100% certain in Bitcoin. Bitcoin is probabilistic through and through. And also the security model of Bitcoin is probabilistic. And there is always the possibility that something goes wrong that we don't know about. But it's also, we kind of, I don't think it would be the end of Bitcoin. Let's put it like this. Like we had things happen in the past where we kind of found a way to fix it, even though it's very messy, you know, and the bigger Bitcoin grows, the messier it gets. But I'm not too worried about zero day exploits or any cryptographic failures or also quantum computing or anything like that. I'm more worried about Bitcoiners in jurisdictions that will have trouble because of the failing of fiat currencies. I think that's a way, way, way bigger risk. Like or also even worse, you know, no coiners in these kind of jurisdictions. Those are the people that are going to suffer most. So I don't worry too much about the cryptography side of things.
Okay. Yeah, that's good to know. And yeah, I think that's all we had. Krishna, did you have anything?
No, that's great. That's pretty much all that we wanted to ask.
Yeah, this is more like an information overload already for our listeners in terms of time and value for value, proof of stake. Prime them over proof of stake, but still, I'm sure like we are going to get a lot of questions on this. But really, really appreciate you coming on the show. Hope to meet you someday in person again.
Yeah, I'll be around. You now know how I look like. So
yeah, I know how you look like. You just have to say which conference you're attending. I'll try to meet you there. Yeah, and really appreciate what you do in this space. I hope to catch up on that someday, on all of your work, and sort of at least replicate in some way or the other, at least match 10% of your contributions that you've made. And just to close things up, where can our listeners find you?
So probably the best place is still Twitter, even though I have a love-hate relationship with Twitter. But I'm there, Gigi on Twitter, DERGIGI, and DERGIGI.com is my site where I publish all my writings, and there are also links to the projects that were mentioned in the beginning. There's also 21lessons.com where you can read the book and also listen to the audiobook. And you can also, like, everything I do is on a value for value basis. So everything that is just information is free online. But you can also buy it on Amazon, the paper version. And there's also 21waysbook.com, even though I'm very slow with writing and publishing the upcoming chapters of the book, but I hope to get it done someday soon. So I have a lot of material that is still about to publish, and yeah, that's basically it.
I think you're getting inspiration from George or Martin, like getting sidetracked with other projects. Not
Yeah, it's a form of procrastination, I guess, doing other things and not actually working on the thing that you should be working on.
But yeah, all the other things that you do are great too. So thanks for that.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for the kind words.
Thank you, Gigi.
All right. Thanks for having me again, guys.
Thanks for coming. Hey, if you've made it this far, thanks for listening in. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe to the show. You can also send us your feedback to hello@bitcoininfinitypodcast.com or visit our website, bitcoininfinitypodcast.com. We're also on Twitter at Bitcoin8Podcast. That is BITCOIN number 8 podcast. As always, this show is meant for educational purposes only and is not financial advice.